Coming up in this week in computer hardware, Samsung explains that battery problem. Facebook gets 2FA keys, a little bit more on Windows 10 game mode, some cool new VR titles, UHD Blu-ray drives from Pioneer, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twitch audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 399, recorded January 26, 2017. VR musical chairs, people.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter code Twitch to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. And by Zipcar. Zipcar is the largest car sharing network in the world. Turn $25 in driving credit. Visit joinzipcar.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, and most engaging discussion of PC, mobile, and, console and every other kind of hardware you can imagine, with occasional forays into not-so-hardware-y stuff. But this week is all about the hardware. By any chance, Mr. Ryan Shrout joining us from beautiful Florence, Kentucky.
Hello.
Did you catch the 50-minute Samsung Apology Fest on Sunday night?
I did not. I would have had I known that it was a thing that was going on. But apparently some pretty interesting and surprisingly technical information really came out from it.
Obviously, right? Samsung Note 7 fires, mayhem,
yeah.
Recalls,
bad news.
Banned from planes, SUVs on fire in driveways. Apparently there's still a small number of Samsung Note 7s in the wild, to the point where the carriers are like, we're going to have to shut down their app. I guess they're going to take like a list of IMEIs and then just cut them off because it's time. But Samsung basically did a full apology. Vlad Savov over at The Verge did a nice write-up on that. I liked the title, especially that the apology was full, humble, and nerdy. And I think nerdy addresses what you said, it being particularly technical, because Samsung presented their findings, followed by the three independent teams that investigated the battery issues. And it basically started out, head of its mobile division, DJ Ko, said, reports Mr. Savov, first of all, I deeply apologize to all of our customers, carrier, retail, and distribution partners. We believe that as a first step to regain your trust, it is important to provide you with a thorough understanding of the cause behind the Galaxy Note 7 incidents and to implement a comprehensive plan to take preventative measures. And what it came down to, I think, really, is that they went too thin. They pushed lithium-ion technology too hard. They didn't put enough QC into it. And things fell apart. There's a new 8-point battery safety check, which includes a durability test, visual inspection, X-ray, charge and discharge test, TVOC test, which is total volatile organic compounds, to make sure that the battery's not leaking, a disassembling test, accelerated uses test, the delta open circuit voltage check, where they continually, I guess, check the battery, from coming out of the box from the battery manufacturer to when the device is completely assembled. They've pushed out the next generation, so it's not going to debut at Mobile World Congress, but will debut when it's done, which I think is a really good idea. The Galaxy, the next generation Note 8, the analysis was kind of like, you know, the auditors, another quote from The Verge, the auditors identify basic failures like missing or uneven insulation tape, charge level inconsistencies, thinner internal separators, and the higher energy density as contributing factors. So, you know, Samsung's basically, we're sorry. Here's what we're doing to prevent it from happening again. You know, look at all of this engineering investigation we've gathered. And I think they're probably not going to talk about it much, if at all, moving forward.
Yeah, I would imagine that from a corporate standpoint, they believe this is hopefully the last time they ever have to mention it. I'm a little concerned, as I think others were, that they weren't able to identify like one single particular fault point. Because like in this Verge article, they talk about the fact that there was actually a, they have a higher capacity battery in the Galaxy 7 Edge, right? They had a 3600 instead of a 3500. So what caused the issues in the battery design here specifically versus that one? Cause it wasn't simply, you know, we were more aggressive because of the higher demands for energy and battery life that our customers seem to have. And, you know, kind of as you labeled off, you know, a set of things that were the problem as opposed to one particular thing means to me that maybe there's not, it's not 100% that this will never happen again under the same or similar circumstances.
Yeah, but, there was a lot of failure, I think, you know, and the, so these sort of cascading sort of, you know, this begat this begat this begat this begat this, and all of those things together combined to create what basically amounts to fires, or the possibility of fire. Fire absolutely happening isn't that big a deal, right? Because people like it when matches work, or barbecue lighters, or igniters for rocket engines, or primers for ammunition. But they get upset if there's a possibility of, for example, their phone bursting into flame. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens also at the launch and how the response to that on their next series of phones, right? Because the next generation phones are starting to appear. And Samsung's got a lot to prove at this point. Not sure what else to say about that one.
Yeah, it is interesting that they kind of have said that they're going to delay the announcement of, you know, their next phone. They didn't directly attribute it to this, but, you know, any additional separation you can get from this discussion will be beneficial for them. Even if it means, you know, being a couple of months late with your product reveal or even your product release, right. I think that benefits them long run. Yeah.
And we wait with bated breath. Interesting announcement. Yes, we always do. Interesting announcement from Facebook this morning is they're now adding support for USB security keys. You know, basically using a physical device for two-factor authentication. They call it security key. So instead of getting a 2FA security code via text message or MSS or using the Facebook app, you can actually keep a physical security key. And if you've never seen one of these, my co-host on TechThink uses one. The one they showed off in the Facebook announcement was the FIDO U2F security key. They're super small. You know, it's smaller than most keys, lighter probably than most keys. You just stick it into a USB port and you use that as your, you know, like your PIN number on your, you know, ATM card or your, you know, extra password or picture selection or whatever your two-factor authentication happens to be. You know, this allows you to not have to sort of, you know, wait for a text message or an SMS message. So the FIDO Alliance is the U2F standard. The FIDO Alliance hosts the U2F standard, the Universal Second Factor standard. And the keys that I'm familiar with and the one that they showed, that FIDO U2F security key, is from YubiKey. And Shannon's been using one of those for a long time for her two-factor authentication for applications that support that. So YubiKey's been around for a while. You know, they work with Facebook, Gmail, tons of online services. You know, when CERN says the YubiKey meets all our requirements thanks to its simplicity of use, its open algorithm, and available open source software support, that's a good, solid endorsement right there. And Facebook obviously could choose any 2FA system, service, or platform it wanted to, and they went for U2F and the security keys there. They're cheap. You know, they're like $18. So it's not like it's financially out of reach.
I didn't know these were things. I didn't know this existed, actually, for like this particular standard and stuff. Yeah. I still feel like this is something I would not have with me or misplace or something. You know, like you put it on your keychain, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Do you lose your keys a lot?
No, but I travel a lot. And when I'm out of town, I don't necessarily have my car keys with me. Right.
Weird.
Something like that.
I'm saying weird because like I travel and my keys are with me till it's time to go into airport security. Then they go in the place they go to in my bag, which is bolted to me for the duration of my trip. So
like my car keys will probably be like in my carry-on suitcase at the hotel while I'm walking around CES, not in my pocket type of thing.
Well, you could perhaps carry a second keychain just for your two-factor authentication needs. But
you could. Yeah.
It's a thought. You know, YubiKey Neo, Phytos.
I like the idea for it. So.
Phytan Multipass. They're inexpensive. It's an alternative. I mean, quite frankly, I'm pretty happy with running 2FA and getting SMS messages over my phone. But occasionally I wonder what happens if I don't have my phone and I need to log into any of the services I have two-factor authentication on, in which case you need to have, you know, Google codes, you know, pre-printed or ready to go for you.
I think anytime you're talking about any physical object, you're going to have the same question. Right.
Yeah.
What if I don't have my keys? What if I don't have my phone? So the ideal thing is being able to integrate more than one two-factor authentication method at a time.
Yes.
Maybe I don't have my phone, but I do have my keys or vice versa, which seems like a good idea.
Two is one. One is none. To get the quote on.
Yep.
Windows 10 Creators Update. We've been mentioning this for a couple of weeks because we've all been kind of curious what's going on. What exactly is the new game mode? And Microsoft is finally explaining, post over the Windows blog, starts out by saying, our vision that the game mode optimizes your Windows 10 PC for an improvement in overall game performance. Which is not particularly surprising.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure that any of it, you know, you're in Windows 10, you go Windows key plus G to pull up the game bar, click on the settings button, and then you can opt into running the game using game mode. And that's all they're really saying about it until they get deeper into Windows Insider testing.
So. Yeah, they surface like the method in which you would enable this feature, hitting the Windows key G, bringing up the game bar that has been a thing since Windows 10 anniversary, I guess, released. And then you'll be able to opt into running the game using game mode, and then we'll have additional details later. So it may do nothing now, and it's just kind of a UI interface for it. I don't really know. I'd be curious if we can sign up for the insider build here and then see if we can maybe do some A/B testing. My hunch is that there is going to be no difference in A/B testing at this point if they're not kind of diving into the details of what it will actually be. But you know, having a centralized location for gaming settings on the PC and kind of having a little bit more universal access to these types of things sounds like it's a good positive, right? At least it shows that they're putting emphasis on that section again.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's that, you know, all you can see, there's a screen grab there, but all you can see is like game mode and a checkbox for use game mode for this game.
Right.
You know, game DVR, you know, checkboxes for record game in the background, show timer while I'm recording, options for showing tips when you start a game, open game bar using, you know, the X key on a controller, show game bar when I play full screen games, Microsoft is verified. Not a lot there, Not a lot there. Nope. So in theory, we'll know more after it's released, but I think they're going to gather a bunch of data and see what it does before they get too deep into
that.
Could
be. Yeah.
Speaking of losing your two-factor authentication keys, this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker. We're all used to losing our possessions, your backpack, your wallet, your 2FA key. Newsweek reports the average American wastes 55 minutes a day looking for things they own but can't find. That's an epic. You get 24 hours in a day. You don't want to spend one of them tracking down the stuff you need, like your keys, which is why you need to check out Tracker. They make losing things a thing of the past, and I'm going to tell you how to get one for free. In case it's not cleared at this point, the Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, luggage, instruments, bicycles, electronic devices, even pets or two-factor authentication keys in seconds. It's a little coin-sized device made out of anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking. You attach it to your items via key loop or adhesive. It's enabled by Bluetooth low energy, so the battery lasts for up to 1 year. You can add a laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like return or pet info, and you can now personalize your tracker with a custom-printed image. And if you look in earlier episodes of the show, you can actually see a tracker with Mr. Ryan Shrout's face on it. Oh, it's classic. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. You can customize two-way separations alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind, which is fantastic in airports or, for that matter, leaving your house. If you lose your phone, you press the button on the tracker, and your phone will ring even if it's on silent. So, hey, it works two ways. Find your stuff. Find your phone. With over 3.5 million devices shipped, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost items show up on a map even if it's miles away. If you lose your item, it's really simple. The Tracker app records its last known location on a map. And when another Tracker user comes within 100-foot range of your item, you will receive a GPS update of where your item is located. It's a good thing. You want to check it out, people? You want to get a free Tracker? Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter the promo code Twitch, that's T-W-I-C-H, you'll get a free Tracker Bravo with your order. That's T-H-E-T-R-A-C-K-R.com, promo code Twitch, and get your free Tracker Bravo today. We want to thank Tracker for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Indeed.
So, VR slowly begins to amass. One of the big questions about VR is what the content's going to be. Obviously, you can head up on Speed, Steam. You can look at some of the various games up there. But VR storytelling was a big breakaway at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. And I liked what Lance Ulanoff over at Mashable said when he was tweeting this out. Quote, finally, a VR breakthrough. Dear Angelica will fog your Oculus Rift with tears. Which sounds really ridiculous, but, you know, we were talking to Will Smith on who's the founder of FooVR, used to run tested.com, about his startup, his VR startup, FooVR. And he said, look, we're still figuring out the languages, the techniques, the storytelling inside of VR. And it's not just gaming. And it's pretty crazy. Dear Angelica, that's a 12-minute animated experience. It shows up on Oculus Rift on Friday. And Miyubi, which is a 40-something minute VR scripted comedy that's going to be on Oculus Rift and Gear VR next month. And, you know, the Mashable's real simple. The author, Josh Dickey, says, quote, Mashable tried more than 20 of the VR experiences at this year's Sundance alone, and nothing anywhere has come close. So this is really, you know, really, really interesting, at the idea that people are trying to figure out how to engage VR and use what VR is capable of to really advance storytelling. Although I think technically, Dear Angelica isn't causing virtual tears on the screen, but that you will be weeping at the end of the 12-minute story. So.
Right. Which could cause complications, you know, just technically and physically on that type of thing. I'm really interested to try this stuff out too. Do they talk anything in this story about having other, like, if you have an Oculus Rift, you can try this movie or buy this movie or stream it or some way at any certain point or date or anything like that? Or is it still kind of only at the festival at this point?
So Angelica's going to show up on, let me double check that. I believe Angelica shows up on Friday.
Okay.
And then Miyubi is going to show up in a month, next month. Goodness. Yeah, I want to say.
Yeah, it's Friday. Yeah. Friday for Dear Angelica on the Rift, and it just says next month for Miyubi.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the big points of the film circuit, the festival circuit, in this case, Sundance being one of the biggest and oldest ones, is that people bring their movies, documentaries, now, VR storytelling or whatever we're going to end up calling it, VR experiences. You go to Sundance because you want to find somebody who wants to distribute that. Like documentaries would be, a ton of them show up on HBO as a classic source, Netflix, Showtime. And in these cases, it looks like, one actually came out of Oculus, storytelling kind of experiment. I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting to see and watch as a, storytelling has been storytelling since people were sitting around a fire. And now you've got, now you've got sort of the latest evolution on that with VR, or maybe the latest evolution with VR that doesn't suck. I mean, one of the things I thought was curious is, for one of them, Dear Angelica, pardon me, depending on how you interact with the story, if you lean into the images, if you explore around sort of the thing you're experiencing, there are Easter eggs in there, and that's their goal, to kind of get people to try it over and over again to see what other interesting things they find inside of there. So, but yeah, Oculus Rift Friday for Dear Angelica, and UB is going to be on Oculus Rift and Gear VR next month. Oculus Story Studio. That's where Dear Angelica is coming out.
Okay. I'm excited to try it. I've played plenty of games. I've gone through plenty of games in VR, and a couple of what they call VR experiences / movies, but they haven't really drawn me in as something that you're being added. That's adding to the experience very much. So both of these claim to be the first step in that. So worth a shot.
Yes, it is. A bunch of other announcements kind of around the VR world this week. Hugo Bera is going to be running Facebook VR, which includes the Oculus Rift team. Hugo Bera has been at Xiaomi. Before that, he was at Google, and now he's going to be at Facebook running the Oculus team and their overall VR experience. HTC's top Vive designers leaving to work on Google Daydream, says The Verge. And that's kind of a big one because, that's Claude Zellweger, and he's been big over at HTC Vive, and now he's working on design at HTC Vive. Now he's going to be working over on the Daydream VR mobile platform. So
it almost seems too early in the lifespan of this product category to see some of these moves that quick, but I don't really know enough to judge whether this is good news, bad news, or indifferent news in terms of some of these moves. The HTC Vive was kind of the out of the gate leader in VR for gaming in particular, excuse me, because of the room scale capability of it, but the possibilities for something like Daydreaming, something that is disconnected in terms of like an actual cable between your body and a PC or something, are there's a substantially higher ceiling for that in terms of install base and what you might be able to do with it long term. It's probably a hit for like a negative for HTC, but for all we know, the roadmap could have been set for the next 2 years for what they plan on doing. And, him moving on at this point is kind of not as concerning for the immediate future of the medium as it might seem. But having used a Google Pixel and the Daydream headset, the VR headset from Google, that is a platform that needs some refinement. It works fine, but some of the availability of games and applications and stuff for it seems fairly minimal still at this point. The controller integration seems okay, moderately okay, I guess. It works well for the technology and the cost involved for all of it, but it doesn't, sure, doesn't compare to what you can get on the other platforms. So, you know, I'm curious to see what he can add to that, and, you know, what, how this might help direct SoC and performance and design decisions kind of going forward on these other systems and other phones to try to improve what the Google Daydream overall type thing will be. I don't know. That it never seemed like Google spent a whole lot of time investing in perfecting kind of the gaming ecosystem they created. They just kind of decided to let the Android developer, you know, Play Store kind of thing happen. Right. And just by consequence of having a massive amount of units out in the market, they can be a leader in that field. I don't know if you'll be able to do the same thing with VR necessarily without, you know, negative feedback and negative results from poor experiences. So I think them investing more direct time on that is a benefit.
It would seem, I don't know, it would seem like something you don't want to leave to chance. And, you know, given the constraints on performance that the Daydream VR platform is, you know, I'll say suffering under compared to the HTC Vive and Oculus, that's certainly something they want to get ahead of. I'm also really curious how much of this is going to be, you know, hardware design, interface design, you know, dealing with the applications. You know, it's also interesting because so many of the people that have left HTC, there's a whole series of, there was a design group that was bought by HTC and you know, this was the last person on that team to finally leave HTC, you know, after about an 8-year run. So, you know, I also thought Claude Zellweger's tweet was pretty funny where he said, you know, I'm joining Google Daydream so you can redirect your criticism.
That's good.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, first it was Scott Croyle who, you know, was working on, who left HTC to start Nextbit, and then Jonah Becker went to do industrial design at Fitbit. And those two, I guess, were the ones that came on board with One & Co. when HTC acquired them back in 2008.
Gotcha.
Actually, Claude Zellweger was part of that team too. That's another one. Vlad Zavov did a nice write-up on that one. But I'm curious to see what this means. And it's also interesting the idea that all three of these teams seem to be, you know, seem to have so much interrelation. Like maybe there's only so much VR talent out there. There's just going to be this musical chair thing as people get bored.
It's true. There's only so many people that have experience with it that is applicable to modern implementations, but.
Interesting question. Article up on Slash Gear also notes that anyone can now make and publish Daydream VR apps, which I have mixed feelings about, given some of the security issues that have been showing up on Android applications in general over the years. Google smartphone-powered Daydream VR platform is more accessible, but has been closed off to outsiders until now. Google has swung the doors wide open, allowing anyone and everyone who is a developer to not only make Daydream apps, but also get them up on the Daydream App Store if they meet the criteria. That's JC Torres up at Slash Gear. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
I agree. Oh, I was going to say, I agree. Like, there's a paragraph here that says, the problem with too open a door is that anyone will really try to get in. And that is exactly the problem with mobile app ecosystems across the board. So I have often lamented to anybody that will listen, whether it be on a show like this or to executives at NVIDIA or Qualcomm or Oculus or HTC, that an onslaught of really bad VR hardware or software will exponentially disadvantage the industry from being successful in any kind of reasonable amount of time. You know, you download a crappy tower defense app on your phone, you realize that you've got 300 more options to try. You delete it and move on. If you download a crappy game that makes you sick or physically ill, and you just write off the whole platform.
Genre, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's, so. I can't argue with that at all. I keep thinking, you know, if Airbenders hadn't been such a horrendous 3D movie, you know, would 3D actually still matter? in home theaters or on televisions these days, but it's like, you know, 3D as a feature is gone for all intents and purposes on televisions now. And I think a lot of that had to do with the horrendous experiences that so many people had with their initial, you know, 3D television experience. It's tough. Atari 2600 for the win. And, you know, while we're talking about hardware leadership moving and shaking, Dropcam's Greg Duffy is leaving Google and going to Apple. He's, you know, Dropcam founder, sells Dropcam to Nest basically at Google for $555 million. Calls the Nest co-founder, who was his boss, a tyrant bureaucrat, and is now going to the company where Tony Fadell, the tyrant bureaucrat, learned how to be a tyrant bureaucrat or got it perfected, which is Apple. You know, a lot of people have been frustrated with the Dropcam experience post-Nest acquisition, and I believe Mr. Duffy has publicly expressed his frustration that perhaps he should not have sold the company. But I think it's interesting to see somebody of that caliber being pulled into Apple and what that means for you know, HomeKit and for Apple home hardware, home automation hardware. Although you could argue that it doesn't take that much to build a networked video camera, because there's 3,000 of them you can buy from, you know, 300,000 different vendors on.
Honestly, I was thinking that I didn't know how to say it really, but it was like huge success. Congratulations to him, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But like you made an internet connected webcam, like,
well, one that worked consistently, which is not trivial, I think.
Yeah. 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 True. You know.
There's a lot of it,
so shut up, Ryan.
I'm not saying that. You know.
No, I said it. Yeah.
But it's tough, right? This is not, you know, advanced VR. This is not a cell phone. This is not a desktop processor. But, you know, it also should be pointed out that unlike a lot of the Internet of Things, and certainly the Dropcam existed before we started thinking of an Internet of Things and all of its issues, it worked and it continues to work, which is why, you know, they afford a premium price on those, I think. Mm. Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is also brought to you by Zipcar. Zipcar is the world's largest car sharing network, operating in over 500 cities, towns, colleges, and more than 50 airports around the world. Zipcar provides a cost-effective alternative to car ownership. Zipsters only pay for the time they actually use a vehicle and have no responsibility for additional costs. Drive cars by the hour or by the day with gas and insurance included. So convenient. With Zipcar, you'll have the freedom to choose where and when you want to drive. Zipcar's self-service vehicles are available on demand in conveniently located reserved parking spots in your neighborhood. You can reserve your Zipcar in minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling or visiting the website. And you simply book the vehicle of your choosing. Unlock your selected vehicle with your Zipcar. And it's nice. You got a lot of choice. Over 50 makes and models of cars that range from environmentally friendly hybrids, EVs, and PHEVs to luxury vehicles, SUVs, pickup trucks. So you can move with something a little more convenient than the big, crazy rental van from the place you can't get to because it's a far corner of town. You got the option to choose even the color of the vehicle you want based on the needs of your trip and the available Zipcars in your area. Reserving, accessing, and using a Zipcar, so easy. If you can operate an ATM, you can rent a Zipcar. Car sharing is good for the environment. Zipsters reduce their personal CO2 emissions by between 1,100 and 1,600 pounds per year. It's good stuff, people. For wheels when you want them and $25 in driving credit, go to joinzipcar.com/twit. That's joinzipcar.com/twit. And we thank Zipcar for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. So nice to have wheels when you want them. It's interesting. People had figured out already how to access Ultra HD Blu-rays. We've been talking about this on AVXL, Robert Heron and I, but now Pioneer has announced Ultra HD Blu-ray supporting BDR/S11J drives. Report comes from Anantech.com. And, you know, it's funny. There's been like an application that will support or promises to support Ultra HD Blu-ray playback. Now we actually have a drive to go with that application or that update that application. you know, their Blu-ray drives, their Ultra HD Blu-ray drives, 5 1/4 inch form factor, SATA 3.0, reading and recording of CD, CDR, CDRW, DVD, DVD plus minus R, DVD plus minus RDL, DVD plus minus RW, DVD RAM, and Blu-ray BD, BDR, SL, DL, TL, QL, BDR, ESL, DL, TL, and BDR LTH discs. Typical 4 MB buffer under run protection, support 16x burning speed for BDR SSL, basically 25 GB BDR media. But they're also claiming they're going to offer some improved audio playback and, of course, support for Ultra HD Blu-ray discs. So, should be nice. They're doing Period 4 Plus and real-time Period functions. Essentially, if you have a trashed audio CD and you can't get the scratches off of this, that'll try to fix or work around the problem. And the more expensive BDR S11JX, writes Nantech, has further enhancements to improve playback quality of inserted audio CDs. And basically they just say, Pioneer's not saying much, but in theory, sort of like industrial grade internal components and playback quality check are designed to help fix issues you have with audio playback. So
the biggest concern for all this is it's not just like if you're trying to build a home theater PC with one of these optical drives, like get ready for a headache, man, because you have to have support for what is it called? AACS 2.0 encryption keys at every layer of hardware, right? Not just like the optical drive and a piece of software. So you have to have a software, you have to have the optical drive, you have to have a GPU that can support it. They only allow the decryption of the key to happen in secured private regions of memory.
Yeah.
Which require certain processor features that only exist in Skylake and beyond CPUs from Intel. And even then, only some of the Skylake processors had it enabled. Some of the early Skylake, like 6700K and that type of stuff, don't have support for it. The motherboard BIOS has to have support for pass-through for this as well. You basically have to have an Intel 200 series motherboard and a Kaby Lake processor. And then you have to have this optical drive and the appropriate CyberLink software to start that process. Yeah. And obviously your display has to be HDCP 2.2 and all the other, qualifications that go along with it as well. I have never seen as strict a subset of hardware that would support playing back an optical media on a PC before.
Well, Hollywood's still a little bit pissed about the whole DVD thing. and the other thing is PowerDB 16 Ultra, which is not quite the last Blu-ray playback software standing, but is practically the last Blu-ray playback software. There's a couple smaller apps, but they announced it was going to support it, but as far as I know, PowerDVD 16 Ultra has not yet implemented the ability to play back Ultra HDs. I'm checking here. Their webpage is a little 1993 GeoCities. I'm exaggerating a lot because I'm cruel, but Yeah, as far as I know, it has not been implemented yet. So maybe that'll come out in PowerDVD 17 Ultra later this year. But it's interesting, right? There's been a bunch of BDXL drives that people have reported on Reddit and elsewhere that they can read Ultra HD Blu-ray discs. It's tough building a home theater right now if you want to do the latest 4K playback. So not going to change anytime soon. What's what's the backstory on, you guys had some more Nintendo Switch news. What's new? I mean, pricing information, right?
Yeah, we had pricing information last week, maybe even 2 weeks ago. This was more, a little bit more detail on the performance side of it and some stuff on Nintendo Switch being able to support FP16, aka half precision compute capability, which may allow it to improve performance at a slight degradation in image quality, but nothing like, again, this is a very different system. So you won't be able to do like A/B comparisons between this and an Xbox One anyway. I guess they did announce new pricing, or it is new that we have pricing on the controllers. So like the Pro controller is $69 and the Joy-Cons, a set of those is $80. So not exactly, discounted or budget-based products. They talked a little bit about their online capabilities, which nobody should have any faith in until it actually gets implemented because of Nintendo. And then some side-by-side videos of Zelda, the new Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild on the Wii U versus the Switch, and kind of seeing what the differences are between there. I'm trying to remember which one's on the right there. I think the Switch is the one on the right. I didn't see the beginning of the video and I can't remember which is which now. Does it say on the video there, guys? Yeah, there you go. On the right is the Switch gameplay and the left is the Wii U. And you'll see there's some color mapping and some tone differences that aren't necessarily indicative of image quality. But in general, you tend to see a little bit more, depth in the on the Wii U. I don't know. It's hard to say. Scott wrote it up on our site and he says, the lighting seemed to be significantly different. Not necessarily worse, just different. In fact, there are situations in which he preferred the Switch over the Wii U and others where it was vice versa. As Link gets out of his hot tub there, you can see some of the differences there. Now, is one better than the other? I kind of prefer the one on the left as opposed to the one on the right, but it almost looks like a tone mapping type of difference as opposed to any kind of graphical fidelity difference. If you look at the story on the website, there are some right pictorial on the edge about, comparisons.
Yeah, I'm feeling the Switch need coming from you right now.
don't get me wrong. I ordered it. So like that scene right there, to me, looks significantly better on the left than it does on the right. The shadowing and all that type of stuff. But I don't know. And I think some of the Wii U footage might have been from an earlier reveal. So maybe it's not indicative of exactly what it will be on March 3rd on these two platforms. But that being said, like I want things to look good, but I'm going to play the game regardless. And it's a Zelda game. It's a stylized it's an art style, not necessarily like a visual fidelity that it's trying to reach like of a specific reality or something like that. So I don't think it will dramatically impact experiences either way. But it's interesting to see what the perf kind of deltas are back and forth.
You should go to PCPro.com to actually see what these videos look like, not to suggest that going from, through the internet compression multiple times reduces your ability to see the real or perceived differences between these. But it's worth getting a closer look on that one. Micro Xbox Project Scorpio white paper leaked. And I think the kind of summation on this is it's going to be more better. Digital Foundry, Scott Michaud wrote this up for PC Perspective. Digital Foundry, quote, received an Xbox Project Scorpio white paper from an anonymous source. They were able to validate its authenticity by sending it to various off-the-record sources. And there's not a lot going on there. There's going to be they're basically, quote, the small on-chip RAM, ESRAM, Microsoft claims that the higher global memory bandwidth removes the need to have it on Project Scorpio. Digital Foundry finds that worrisome because they're not sure if 320 gigabytes per second of bandwidth is going to be enough or if it's going to create latency issues. you know, the, you know, it's, there's, I want to be excited about this and Ultra HD gaming, you know, coming off the Xbox platform, but it still seems so incredibly early. You know, ESRAM's essential for the Xbox One, the Xbox One S, but Project Scorpio and PC are not provided with ESRAM. So, yeah, you know, there's, you know, in part of the justification for that is, you know, quote, developers not allowed to ship a Project Scorpio only SKU, i.e. it has to play on all the platforms, the game does. Optimizing for ESRAM remains critical to performance on Microsoft platforms. So, you know, target aliasing helps with memory savings, you know, dealing with the 32 megabyte limit on that. I don't know. You know, it's just, I'd like to see more detail, but I think they're keeping it pretty close to the chest at this point at Microsoft.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, in effect, Microsoft is saying that half-res effects run at 1080p and a 4K frame buffer will look better than a native 900p. So, you know, sparse rendering or checkerboarding, they're recommending for Scorpio.
The white paper still mentioned the 6 teraflop compute capability, which, you know, that was what was rumored at the beginning, and now we're seeing that sustained through it, so it seems what we'll actually see. And that's, I think that's a 4x improvement. I think the current Xbox One is like 1.5 teraflops, so 4x improvement in potential compute capability. It's going to be interesting. One of the articles I read about it, you know, brought up the fact that this would create, even between the PS4 Pro and the Scorpio, a more significant delta in performance for similar generation consoles than we've ever seen. And then you get into the debate of how much effort and work does it require for these developers to take advantage of it? Is it simply that, like, oh, you know what, on the Scorpio, we'll be able to render it 4K, and on the PS4 Pro, you know, 1080p and upscale or something like that? Well, or the possibility exists that if the PS4 continues to be the largest install base, that they really spend all their time targeting that and kind of ignore the added performance and capabilities that Scorpio has, which is, you know, traditionally been the problem that PC gamers have dealt with, is everybody targets console level performance and they go, and we'll port it over to the PC and, you know, make whatever tweaks we have time and budget to actually do, which can be minimal. So, there has been a benefit to kind of going with each other within, you know, a certain margin of error in terms of performance, because you didn't, you know, you put less impetus on the developer to spend time doing things. And this will be the widest gap that has existed ever, I believe, in the console market.
Well, it's also, I mean, you know, people are certainly satisfied with Xbox One performance, but, you know, it also highlights, half resolution rendering typically used for transparency, screen space effects, SSAO, SSR, and perhaps even shadow accumulation, accumulation, global illumination, and non-important local lights, you know. And so those are rendered at 900p, you know, and then on Scorpio, they'll be rendered at 1080p and upsampled to 4K. So it's kind of like Project Scorpio. We're finally bringing 1080p to the Xbox One platform. It's an interesting thought. Again, we wait with bated breath. Gigabyte GTX 1060 G6. A decent card with a bit of work, says the crew over at Hard OCP. You know, they liked it a lot after they finished tweaking it, I think is what it comes down to. You know, heatsink and fan combination is Gigabyte's WindForce technology, solid metal black plates, 10.9 inch length. You know, it's a kind of a typical 1060. They seemed a little frustrated in the early testing, but once they got it configured, things were not so bad. you know, cooling does not hold back the overclocking potential of the card. So the, and it's funny, the final page of the review seems to have disappeared, which makes me wonder what happened.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh. Yeah. Well, it ends at power. It was there before, I think. In any case, website vagaries, non aside, it's always interesting to see that all of the variations slowly getting tested over time. I don't know. I mean, you guys are pretty happy, you know, with the budget Radeon RX 460 build you did. And the giveaway, when is the deadline for the giveaway on that one?
People still have another 4 or 5 days to enter. Okay. Yeah, that's it. If you just go to PCPro.com and look for the RX 460 contest, we're running, giving away that full PC worth about $550. So, yeah, definitely enter for your chance to win that. There's going to be somebody's going to be happy next week.
So to get the Gigabyte GTX 1060 G6 overclocking, the gaming mode, the overclocking was weak. And then they had to manually overclock the card to get the full boost performance out of it because it had more than enough cooling to get a better overclock. So they had to install the Extreme Engine VGA utility. And then you can, then that they were able to manually play around with the voltage and the clocks. Which should offer a noticeable improvement from its performance straight out of the box. So, goodness, jumping around there a little bit. EVGA Supernova 8050 G3 PSU. Another editor's choice award for a power supply. There seem to be a lot of really good power supplies right now.
Yeah, that's the thing, is people have gotten really good at manufacturing power supplies. And at the end of the day, wattages have kind of leveled off. We're kind of regressing a little bit. I don't want to say regressing, that sounds like a negative, but we're kind of stabilizing on more sane levels of power consumption, you know, your 500 to 900, 500 to 1,000 watt power supplies. And they've nailed down how to do it. And now they're doing things like improving efficiency, improving, you know, fan profiles, all that type of stuff, in order to get it a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better. And this one does exceptionally well. It does get an editor's choice from Lee, which doesn't happen, you know, that often. Although you're right, it does seem to be a lot of really good ones are coming out recently.
This is a good one.
Oh yeah.
Oh my goodness. The, 80 plus gold certified, 92% efficiency, outstanding voltage regulation between, plus one and minus 1% on the three primary outputs, excellent ripple and noise suppression, hydraulic dynamic bearing on the 130 millimeter cooling fan, which kept it quiet, fanless operation at low to mid power. It's only 5.9 inches deep, SLI and AMD crossfire ready, all Japanese made capacitors, and a 10-year warranty. It was interesting. So
yeah, 10-year warranty is great. Seeing like the efficiency as high as it is and the prices on it aren't exceptionally high, right? It's not a platinum or titanium level 80 plus rated thing. So that helps keep prices a little bit lower. Even when you stretch up to like the 850 watt level of power.
There you have it. Oh my goodness. The brain, it fades. Sebastian did a nice write up on Aptx versus Bluetooth. Look at Qualcomm Aptx, right? So if you never played around with it, Bluetooth audio used to be a nightmare. It wasn't until 2003 that A2DP, Advanced Audio Distribution Profile, brought support for, you know, what they called high quality, what I would call weak ass stereo. It was horrendous in the early days. It was profoundly unpleasant. That left an opening for Aptx to come in to offer a higher performance experience on that. Aptx is always been enormously difficult to test in a lot of cases, because there's, in most cases, there's no switch. There's no, you have to have multiple devices, for example, that one is Aptex and another isn't. For you know, I did some testing with it. I ended up using like a first generation iPad that wouldn't support Aptex versus a later generation device that would support Aptex on Android. But
right.
It's interesting that Qualcomm bought Aptex. You know, I would say it was a company called CSR that started it. And the research for it goes back to a guy named Dr. Stephen Smith, who was doing a triple E, PhD triple E at Queen's University Belfast School of Electronics. And, you know, basically combining, ADPCM, but trying to not do any psychoacoustic puttering with it. And then came up with a custom DSP integrated circuit, which got turned into sort of a software implementation. You know, it's used for all sorts of commercial compression for audio. There was Aptex. Aptex was acquired by CSR in 2010. CSR was bought by Qualcomm, I want to say super late in 2015. You know, and the idea was that it would be, it would offer better compression and therefore increased audio quality over Bluetooth transmission, for audio. And it had to be implemented in both the transmitter and receiver. So your headphones had to be Aptex and your phone had to be Aptex, for example. Sebastian got a chance to get hands-on with that with a really nice set of, they're really, really good the Sennheiser Momentum Wireless over-ear headphones, and I want to say an LG phone on that one. And he's had a experience I think is really, really similar to a lot of other people trying to do A/B testing on this, which is, I think it sounds better, but it's really hard to tell.
His experience to me was that it definitely sounded better than Bluetooth headphones, like standard right. Bluetooth headphones, but well, the comparison to Bluetooth wired, I don't know. I'd have to look and see.
You know, you'd have to do like switch between and that's where it gets tough, right? Because, you know, the Sennheiser Momentum are probably one of the two best Bluetooth headphones out there. It's, you know, it'd be the Sennheiser Momentum, which also does active noise cancellation, and B&W's P7. Both play in that $300 to $400 range. They both have probably the best audio playback you're going to get on Bluetooth, because you don't find a lot of super expensive Bluetooth headphones. And in fact, the crew over at the Wirecutter really like. Goodness, they had a really nice choice. There it is. Jabra's Move Wireless, which sell for like $100, you know, as little as 70, as much as $100 for the Jabra Move. They sound great. They don't have loss issues, but it's kind of crazy for a serious improvement, right? You go from like $100 for those Jabra headphones to $400 for the Momentum 2.0 wireless. You know, that's, $420 now. On mm-hmm. Amazon for the Momentum 2.0 wireless. So it's tough. It's tough to do a comparison, because you can't really turn Aptex and Bluetooth on and off in the device you're listening to. So you either have to switch devices or play around with that. But
when I was at a Qualcomm tech day once, they had a setup to try to do A/B testing where you were listening to the same headphones, and they had basically a physical switch, right? You'd hit play on two devices at the same time. One of them connected wired, one of them connected wirelessly, and they would have that physical like conversion over that was happening. Obviously, as an end consumer, you don't have access to a device like that to do the A/B testing necessarily. So it is a bunch of kind of listening between devices and listening between headphones and stuff as well. You're right.
Right. No, it's good stuff. You know, it's not, you know, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's never a bad thing to have Aptex. The trick is finding, especially if you're looking for Bluetooth streaming to headphones, finding Aptex support in the headphones. A lot more common than it used to be. You know, there were still moments when I thought I was hearing a difference, but it was only when I was listening for it. And that's looking at like FLAC and ALAC files, jazz files, which are enormously difficult to compress using the VLC app, right, Sebastian's. Overall, the sound was fantastic and by far the best wireless experience I've had to date. I'll add that the Sennheiser Momentum headphones are incredible in their own right. I would agree 100% with that. This standard implementation of AptX was perhaps a little behind the wired sound with complex passages, but that was with CD quality audio. I must point out that AptX HD audio exists, and I would love to compare that to wired sound in my library of 24-bit music, and it's exciting. So, you know, if you got an LG G5 or any other AptX-compatible phone, certainly taking a look at a superior set of headphones, such as the Sennheiser Momentum 2.0, is definitely worth checking out. It's good stuff.
Very cool.
Yeah. Trick is finding them. Man, I'm trying to remember if the, I don't think the Jabra Move Wireless supports AptX. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. I don't know. I will also say there are a lot of inferior wireless headphones that include AptX.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, you've got to treat it as two separate entities. Like AptX is a transmission tech, but if you have crappy headphones attached to it, then you're still going to have crappy headphones, regardless of what the transmission process is like of data wirelessly. But yeah.
There you have it. Anything coming up on PC Pur you can give us a heads up on?
Probably. I bought that 4K TV, the OLED LG B6, and it's been here at the office for 3 days, and I have not taken that out of the box, and it makes me very sad.
Why?
On the inside. It's a legitimate question and concern, and I need to rethink my life priorities. But...
You should call Robert Aaron out to set it up for you and calibrate it.
I want to set it up here, and like Resident Evil 7 came out on the PC and on consoles this week, and it supports HDR gaming on the PC version. So like I'm in the middle of building a system to install Resident Evil 7 on it, so I could hook up this TV and kind of like see how it all works. That's kind of my goal. I want to turn it on and I want to be impressed. That's kind of where I'm at this point. So
That's all I'm asking for is just impress me.
Just impress me. Like, you know, it's tough sometimes. You're doing this a long time. It's incremental upgrades. I see HDR at CES again. That's what sparked it, right? I came back from CES deciding I needed to have an HDR screen. And through several recommendations, one of which was Robert's as well, this seemed like the best TV for me. And now hopefully we can use it and see what it does for PC gaming in addition to other gaming. And, you know, hey, movies too. Why not?
If I were going to tease you mercilessly, I might point out that the HDMI 2.1 spec, which was kind of mostly announced at CES and should be done by sort of April, May, June, and will probably be showing up with HDR TVs at the end of 2017 and certainly in force at CES 2018, will afford up to 120 frames per second on 4K gaming and, of course, support for dynamic HDR, which allows you to set the HDR per scene rather than the way it's done currently, which is a sort of set of HDR values for the entire movie. So you may be ready to buy a new, HDR TV for gaming just next year.
No. Not, I mean, probably. Let's be honest.
How many monitors are in that room with you right now? 34?
Yeah, something to that effect. Yeah.
22.
Yeah, we'll see.
117. Oh, my goodness. I've been looking at too many mesh networking systems, and I'll be talking about those next week on Tech Thing and here on This Week in Computer Hardware, including, Netgear's Orbi, Eero, so many to talk about. That's all I'm going to say about it right now. It's like the late winter of routers at my house. That's all nice. I can say without bursting into tears and panic. I also will say, be careful testing multiple wireless devices in your home. You may really upset your wife and children when they can't get anything to play on the TV.
Gotcha.
Oh my goodness. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, We want to thank you for listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, a.k.a. Twitch. You can find more episodes and how to subscribe at twit.tv/Twitch. You can find more of Mr. Ryan Shrout at pcper.com. You can find me at techthing.com and avxl.com. You can find both of us on Twitter at Ryan Shrout or at Patrick Norton. We invite your hardware questions. Send them out anytime. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.